Welcome to the seventh episode of the Berkeley Institute Live podcast, Technology, Surveillance, and COVID-19, the Israel Experience. Today's episode features three amazing guests, Professor Neva Elkin-Koren in conversation with UC Berkeley professors Ken Bamberger and Shafi Goldwasser. They will discuss technology and surveillance as it relates to COVID-19 in Israel. This episode is part of the Berkeley Institute for Jewish Law and Israel Studies Live podcast series. Episodes every Tuesday and Thursday engage students and faculty on timely topics related to Israel, to Jewish law, thought, and identity. Each episode is aired live and consists of 30 minutes of interview, followed by an interactive Q&A. So our guests today are Professor Ken Bamberger, who is the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation Professor of Law at UC Berkeley, and he's also a faculty co-director at the Berkeley Institute for Jewish Law and Israel Studies and at the Berkeley Center for Law and Technology. Shafi Goldwasser will join us as well, who is the director of the Simons Institute for the Theory of Computing, the C. Lester Hogan Professor in Electronical and Engineering and Computer Science at UC Berkeley, an RSA Professor of Electronic Engineering and Computer Science at MIT, and also a Professor of Computer Science and Applied Math at the Weizmann Institute of Israel. Now I turn it over to Ken, who will introduce our third speaker.
Thanks to you and to the undergraduate fellows at the Berkeley Institute for Jewish Law and Israel Studies who have worked so hard to put together this incredible series at a time that we can't physically be together to hold discussions, keeping our community vibrant during these hard shut-in times. We're extremely lucky to have with us today Professor Neva Elkin-Koren, former dean of Haifa Law School, professor of law, former head and director of the Haifa Center for Law and Technology, and a leading scholar on intellectual property and technology, and a longtime friend and affiliate and colleague of UC Berkeley. Welcome, Professor Elkin-Koren. Welcome, Neva. Maybe we can start. Israel has really been on the forefront of using technology and big data and surveillance in combating COVID-19 and dealing with the public health threat. Maybe you could just take a few moments and lay the landscape for us, set the foundation. What has Israel been doing? How has it fit in with their other efforts in terms of testing, in terms of contact tracing, in terms of social distancing and public health monitoring?
Yeah, I think it's a great question because the title for this meeting is surveillance. And I think that it's really important nowadays to look at digital tools rather than surveillance, because a lot of digital tools are being used in order to address this health crisis, not just in Israel, but also in other places. And I think that basically they're being used, and I mean digital tools in terms of tracking people, right, and collecting information about people, but also using data analytics and predictive models. And I think it's really important to see the whole package of tools that are being used, because this is part of the implications. And they are being used basically, I think that primarily now for the epidemiological investigation, right, in order to track patients and those who have been in proximity with patients. But also, I think increasingly we see now the, you know, tools that are being developed or introduced in order to predict the outbreak of the disease in particular locations, to enforce the self-isolation regulation by the police. You know, this is a different type of use of these digital tools. Again, increasingly now we see tools that are being introduced or proposed to be developed for shaping the exit strategy, right, for addressing, you know, some of the things that we see in China and, you know, of allowing people to somehow come out of isolation and use the public domain in way that would not put other people at risk. So these are the four purposes. I think that we see a lot of these tools being used in Israel. And what is really interesting about Israel is that it has taken basically four strategies for using these tools. The first is mandatory, right? And I think that that has received a lot of headline news in the United States and elsewhere. And that is a mandatory strategy where the government is actually using the tools of the Israeli national secret agency, the Shin Bet, in order to identify potential people that are at risk because they've been in a proximity with a confirmed patient. And this mandatory strategy was actually discovered. You know, it was announced by the Prime Minister by mid-March, followed by petitions to the Supreme Court, and then questions or deliberations in the Parliament when it was established. Maybe we can come back to that later. And a journalist investigatory story by an investigative journalist, Ronen Bergman, in Yediot Ahronot, that actually described this not as a new type of tracking by the Shin Bet, and I think this is important, but actually reveal that Israel is keeping record of all communication interactions on a permanent basis. And what's new about this emergency situation is that the Shin Bet was authorized to use this permanent record in order to address the pandemic. And so
what kind of data are they tracking?
So they're not tracking, that is the point. This data is being recorded regularly. It has been used always only for addressing national security threats, and because this is the authority of the Shin Bet. What they're now doing is that they were authorized for the first time, and that is why it's so controversial, to dig into that data set that is out there and pull data regarding geolocation location data on the cell phones of confirmed patients. This data is provided to them by the Ministry of Health. Once the data is provided, the Shin Bet is able to actually identify the other cell phones that were in proximity with this particular cell phone, and then send, Ministry of Health is sending alerts to these patients and requiring them to get into self-isolation according to the emergency regulation that we have. This is a mandatory, but I think it's really important to put this in context of the other steps that have been taken by the government. Right. And the second strategy is voluntary. And it's actually a cool app that was developed by the Ministry of Health. It's called in Hebrew Hamagen, which I think it means...
the shield.
The shield, right, the shield. And it's an app that could be voluntarily uploaded by any of the citizens, any user, and it keep track of your location, but the record is kept only on your cell phone. This record is actually being updated by the Ministry of Health, but this is only unidirectional. It doesn't report to the Ministry of Health or any other external agency. It only received data from the health ministry on a regular basis regarding the location of confirmed patients. And if it cross-reference with any of the locations that you visited, you will get a notice that you need to report to the health ministry that you are now at risk and now under the obligation to go on self-isolation. There are two other strategies of using digital tools that I think I should mention, because I think that they're important not just for the current situation, but also for what is ahead of us. One is the what we've seen over the past week or so, and that is the introduction of the HMOs into the playground. And so they became more involved, and now they are running surveys with some NGOs and private companies regarding the health situation of their patrons or, you know, subscribers. The members of, you know, that are affiliated with the HMOs receive this survey on a regular basis. It's anonymized, but it allows the HMOs to actually predict where their areas that are more infected, less infected, receive some data on location, geographical locations.
And just to be clear, every Israeli is in an HMO, right? There's a national health system. You can enroll in one of four different HMO plans, but it's the entire population.
Yes, this is the entire population. And I think this is also important in the sense that this also gives a hint of what ahead of us, that is more involvement of of the civilian part of the government that might be able to take control over the pandemic at one point when we are moving from the really critical stage into more moderate stage of an exit strategy. Right.
Eva, can I ask you something about these surveys? So I assume these surveys are also about symptoms. Then, since it's by the HMO, there must be some sort of medical information that's being collected rather than just location. Is that correct?
Yeah, so I can, this is actually depends on the HMO, but my own HMO actually provides... they have my information because I'm a member of that HMO. They have my entire medical record, actually. But the only questions that they ask me are about whether I'm suffering from any of the symptoms, how do I feel, if I have fever, if I took fever, whether I was in touch with any people, if I'm working outside the house, how many people under 18 or above 18 I met. Today, it's on a daily basis that we do that. I think in terms of my medical history, there is nothing there. I think the only health-related question, besides the question about the symptoms of the coronavirus itself, that is coughing, fever, lack of taste and smell, and The only health-related question is whether you're a smoker, but that's it.
I guess my other question, I mean, it does tie into a legal question down the line, is this seems to be the same form for everyone, but since they have access to your record, you could imagine a specialized form, or more importantly, specialized advice. So I understood that some of the HMOs now are talking about coming up with advice to particular patients of how restrictive quarantine they should have, how careful they should be. I assume later on, this will be true even when we get out of this kind of period, very extreme period. And the question is, who gets this information? Mm-hmm. Is it just the patient, or?
Right. So it's unclear. Right now, it's the, you know, HMOs are now, you know, this survey is really, it's really basic, right? And it's, according, there are terms of use. We actually have to agree every time we get into the survey on a daily basis, and it's voluntary, you know, I don't have to do that. And they don't even address me by my name. All my correspondence with my HMO on my cell phone is by name. And this is really, I don't know whether it's anonymous or not, but it pretends to be anonymous. It's assumed to be anonymous and it declares that it's anonymous. I don't know whether there are any, you know, and I think that HMOs are actually under strict regulation. So, you know, maybe they're not doing the right thing, but I guess, there are many safeguards in this situation that can actually make sure that they're not misusing, you know, the information that is provided to them.
So I'm less concerned
about that. I'm more concerned about the fourth strategy that I wanted to mention, and that is collaboration with the private sector. And a lot of private commercial companies that are initiating all sorts of collaboration with the government, and they are under, you know, regular, you know, we have some privacy laws in Israel, but I think that a major concern in that context is that a lot of very sensitive personal information would leak to private companies, and we will lose control of it when it is either misused, used in other contexts, used for the learning algorithm that would be applied in other contexts. I mean, this is where a lot of the concern, in my opinion, is.
Can you give us an example of one of those public-private partnerships?
Right, and so I could have, if there were actually, I mean, if they were launched, but I think one that was discussed and there was actually a signed contract between the Ministry of Health and MyHeritage, that is, of course, you know, that proposed to open a lab in Israel for diagnosing coronavirus and also link it to its you know, genetic research. They were supposed to invest a lot of money. And on the one hand, you would say, this is terrific, right? We need the funding in these times, and we also definitely need the knowledge that this company has, but this is a company that had such a bad reputation in terms of leakage of data, and also there were concerns about the contract that was not public, and this is like these type of contracts, and what is exactly the details of this transaction between the government and a private company, how the information is going to be used, what type of data is going to be available to them, what were the precautions that were taken in order to make sure the data would not leak and be used by others. These are major, major concerns. But the contract was not published. Eventually, this contract was freezed, you know, for other reasons, I think for other reasons related to the way in which it was negotiated, you know, not according to the rules.
So, question for you, Nivas, it's sort of important for all of these four strategies. It sounds like, for example, in this last example that you gave, it's sort of ad hoc. So somebody found out about it and protests have started, and the way that it got frozen was using some legal means which are not directly related to the anonymity, but for some other reason. So is there some framework or some regulation or some standards that that need to be adhered to? Or is it just kind of, you know, the Wild West, and if you manage to know about some clear violation of privacy anonymity in the sense of what you feel is a violation, then some press or effort is done to mitigate it. because I just the last sentence, I had an interview with Andrew Tang, who is the Minister of Digital Innovation in Taiwan. And she told me that after they had the SARS epidemic, where they had 36 deaths, they went through some sort of constitutional revision, saying that in a time of crisis, there are certain measures that are allowed to be taken to protect people from a patient and the patient themselves. And when this started, they extended that to the digital domain, and they've created something called the digital fence, and it's okay according to their law, but there is a law. And I was wondering, how does that play out in Israel?
So this is a great question, because I think one of the interesting things is that Israel was caught in this health crisis when we were also facing a constitutional crisis. And so we are run by a government that was not re-elected three times. And then our parliament was not convened when the pandemic, you know, became widespread in Israel. And our courts were actually closed by or shut down by an executive order that was issued based on emergency regulation. So this combination of challenges actually brought us into a very risky situation. In normal times, we do have rules, and the rule of law would require that any invasion of privacy and any restriction of freedom of movement, for instance, would have to be done in a, you know, by law, in a proportionate way, you know, with reasonable ground, after considering all the alternatives.
And with judicial review.
Mm-hmm.
And with judicial review.
Right, right. And so the way, and so this is the downside. So this, you know, constitutional crisis, I think, was even worse than the health emergency, because we could have actually, you know, it could have turned us into a non-democratic state to be under such extreme surveillance and subject to executive orders with no judicial review. Luckily, and that is again something that is really, I think, typical of Israel, is that a lot of the other players have been really active. So civil society has been active in bringing petitions to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court actually took action in saying, well, mandatory surveillance by the Shin Bet might be necessary, because this pandemic is really getting out of control here, and maybe we need to do that in order to save life. But you have to do it subject to parliamentary oversight, and you have to do it subject to human rights, and you have to do it subject to judicial review. And thanks to that intervention, actually, the parliament has convened, and the committee that is supposed to oversight the Shin Bet was established. And there were actually very effective hearings, public hearings, that were transferred to the public via Zoom. I think that you can actually watch it, because I think it was recorded. Where the government has been questioned about the scope of surveillance and the type of data, the exact data that has been used by the Shin Bet. Some of it was public and some of it was you know, behind closed doors. But the bottom line was first, and this has actually came out in the public session, that it turned out that the Shin Bet is using not only geolocational data about where you've been right? Where the cell phone of the confirmed patient was identified, and what were the cell phones that were identified in the proximity. But they were also using communication data, namely, what were the phone calls that you were making? Now, why would that matter, right, for identifying people who were close to you? I mean, my mother, who is 85 years old, she lives far away now. She's isolated. I cannot visit her. I talk to her 3 times a day, right? But it is exactly because she's not within my proximity. And so there were really, important questions that were raised in these deliberations in the parliamentary committee that is oversighting the Shin Bet. And actually they revised, some of these authorities and asked them to come back with some new regulation or some new procedures on how they are going to exercise their powers. At the same time, the petitions in the Supreme Court are still going on. So what we have is actually 3 types of oversight on the Shin Bet. One was implemented by the general attorney that required the Shin Bet to report to the Knesset or our parliament every 3 days about everything that they are doing. And so that is how we get some information about whether this is successful or not, how many people are involved with using, because otherwise the Shin Bet is not a transparent body. And so we normally would get very little information about their procedures and techniques. Second type of oversight is by the parliamentary committee that can question and restrain some of the powers that are, if they're not approving the government executive orders, the government has to revise them. And the third is the ongoing oversight by the High Court of Justice, Bagats, that has been very active in closely oversighting, the use of power by the Shin Bet.
I want to ask a question. I know this we're almost out of time of the interview part, but it's a little bit more of a technical question. So it seems like these 3 oversights, for example, in this last part that you were talking about, they don't involve scientists. So the reason that I'm talking about involving scientists or technologists is because there's a question of how to, how to enforce these things and to kind of make it clear that there are tools out there to get the kind of information you want without necessarily giving up on anonymity and privacy. So even if technically, like you're saying, that proximity is what matters, not necessarily location. It's important that you were near someone, but not where you were. So that's, and there are technical ways to find one rather than the other. So I'm not hearing that those technologists and scientists are involved in the discussion. And it seems to me, since we're using technology to help us to find out who's out there, we should also use technology in order to help us to find out who's out there and getting infected or infecting others while preserving privacy and anonymity. But that requires experts in the area. Are they at all part of the conversation?
Yeah, so this is an excellent point. I think, first of all, in the parliament, there were experts that were invited by the committee. And since this was like public, both for the public deliberation, but also to the conversation behind closed doors. And so I think they consulted some not just the legal experts and civil society advocates, but also some technologists. I think that also when you look at the voluntary app that has been initiated and developed by the Ministry of Health, a lot of technical people were involved, and I think this is a great example of what we call privacy by design, because there was a lot of effort that was made to keep the data in control of each of the users, to use ways of decentralizing the data and only minimize the way in which you can you actually have to expose your personal data for the purpose of protecting, you know, the public health. And I think more importantly even, this app was released in the format of open source, which makes it subject to oversight by all of the technical people. So I have a lot of conversation with people that are saying that they looked at the app. You know, some people were concerned about what it is. Maybe it does collect more information than it says, but it's open source. So you can actually ask people. You know, I cannot read the code, but some of your colleagues can. And I think that is where it's really important in order to create more trust and legitimacy, you know, in the public.
Let me maybe close the open discussion section with a question looking to the future. And that's, you know, we have this need for speed right now. The technology is being kind of put together on the go. The legal responses are being abridged to some degree. And, you know, all of this oversight takes time. Parliament takes time. Judicial review takes time. Obviously, the very fact that the Shin Bet is looking at national security data that has traditionally only been for a single purpose, for something else, is a really big deal. A boundary has been broken. So the question is, as we come down the other side and look forward, are there ways to put those boundaries back up, or will we have become used to this kind of speedy intervention that's satisfies but doesn't optimize the balance between public and private goals?
Yeah, I think that's a great question and a huge challenge. I think in the short run, I think I know this is unpopular probably to say that, but I think that given the alternative, maybe the use of the Shin Bet in this situation hasn't been that bad. I mean, I cannot believe myself saying this, but the reason is that this type of data has not been collected. It's already being recorded, right? It's a question whether we should continue to hold this type of data, right? But since there is a system that allows you to do that and to pull this information in a very efficient way, maybe for this short-run emergency situation, with all the downsides of using the Secret Service to do that, and these are obvious, so I'm not going to list them, right? I mean, this is like, but I'm sure it's obvious for everyone that this is a bad thing, right? Because this is like the public is not your enemy. These are patients, right? These are citizens, and we all deserve our the protection of our privacy. But at the same time, maybe this was important or useful for saving lives. Just to give some data on this, just today, YNET, that is one of the leading online newspapers in Israel, reported that 1,500 confirmed patients were actually identified due to this system. And when we think about Israel, that has right now about 9,000 confirmed patients. This is it's a fair amount.
That's 1/6 of the cases.
Now, of course, one can say maybe they would have been detected even without that data, but the what if argument doesn't go that far. I think your point about the day after is really important, and there are two aspects to that. One is that I think it's critical for us now to try and move to civilian infrastructure. So we need to develop the infrastructure that would enable us to have the epidemiological investigation using some civilian tools. And I think it's better to have those tools in control of the government, just because the government, the civilian part of the government, or the national part, the HMOs are good. They're not government, but they're sort of regulated, strictly regulated through in terms of their privacy commitment. But I think at the same time, it's really important to also enable the private sector to jump in and bring knowledge and capabilities if we really want to do that. And I think that is where the challenge is. How do we, on the one hand, develop this type of capability in the private sector? There are a few things that we need to do in order to enable this. First is to stop using the Shin Bet for this. And the reason is that, and it doesn't matter whether this is a Shin Bet or another company that was put on the table, the NSO, that is also a private company, that has access to the Shin Bet materials, that wanted access to the data that is being used by the Shin Bet. I think that the data itself is a main resource for developing data-driven systems that can actually predict who is going to be a patient, where there is going to be an outbreak. And so the question is how to give access to that data that is so important for training the algorithms, and at the same time protecting the privacy of the citizens.
It sounds like we have our topic for an upcoming podcast. So look forward to having you back to discuss those structures the day after and those governance challenges.